Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This morning, President Barack Obama was sworn in for a second term on a Bible owned by Martin Luther King Jr. This is the second time the inauguration and MLK Day have coincided since it became a federal holiday. And a lot of people in the media, a lot of commentators are trying to make parallels between the president and Martin Luther King Jr. A lot of us were wondering if President Obama was going to talk about the growing inequality and poverty rate in the United States. He said, we, quote, must be a source of hope to the poor, the sick, the marginalized, and the victims of prejudice, end quote. So 45 years after MLK's Poor People's Campaign, what is the state of economic justice in the United States? Back in 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. said, quote, it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starving wages, end quote. In this morning's speech, President Obama said an economic recovery has begun. But as we mentioned on last week's show about jobs, most of the jobs are paying less than $13.50 an hour with no benefits. And according to the census, we've got 45 million people living in poverty. It's the first time poverty has risen to that level since President Lyndon B. Johnson's war on poverty in 1964. So what will it take to get real action on income inequality and poverty in this country? On today's Your Call, we'll be talking with economic justice advocates about these issues and also to get their reaction to the president's speech. And I'd like to welcome Samuel Kang to the show. Samuel is general counsel for the Greenlining Institute. That is a national policy organizing and leadership institute working on racial and economic justice. Samuel has worked at several NGOs on issues ranging from sanctions in Iraq to economic development in New York's West Harlem neighborhood. And Samuel joins me here in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Pleasure to be here, Rose.
It's great to have you. So a lot of us were listening to the speech this morning wondering if the president was going to talk about economic inequality and poverty. And I just mentioned the line. He talked about hope for the poor, the sick, and the marginalized. Overall, just based on the issues that you work on and care about every day, what was your reaction to the speech?
Well, I think my reaction was it went as expected. Inaugural speeches don't tend to be speeches that give a lot of lucidity in terms of the specific policy points. I think presidents tend to save that for the State of the Unions because they happen around the same time. But as a progressive, as someone who advocates for the very folks that I think the president got elected on, it's a speech that was a little bit, I thought, less than profound, quite frankly, than what I was expecting.
What makes you say that? Because Twitter is abuzz over the fact that he brought up Selma and Seneca Falls,
sure.
Talked about rights for gays. A lot of sure. people are saying, finally, someone is connecting all of these movements.
Sure. I think what the president did well was, of course, mention that in a national spotlight and mention those movements as a continuum. But I think he also didn't do a lot in terms of really clarifying the challenges that we face in terms of how much damage has been done to the economy for those who were not just in the middle class, but in the lower middle classes and those who are just struggling to get by. He mentioned several times in his speech about that the economy is recovering, and he mentioned several times about the growing recovery of the broad shoulders of the middle class. But there are folks in our communities, and right here in San Francisco, just down the street, where their household wealth has been eviscerated since this president took over, though he's trying to fix the problems of the previous administration. The problems of those communities are still ever present.
So paint us a picture. What concerns you the most right now?
Well, one of the things that we work on at the Greenlining Institute is just the wealth in our communities. Because as a civil rights organization, we don't just see that as social issues. We believe that in order to get access to your civil rights, as Americans, we must first have access to our capital rights to execute on our civil rights. And one thing that's really bothered us through the last 4 years is the inattention that's been paid to communities, specifically communities of color in this country. So let me give you one example. The foreclosure crisis, who that hit the hardest in this country were communities of color. communities of color were sold the American dream to say, hey, you can have this piece of the pie as well, and this is how you build, this is how you build your wealth. And traditionally, this is how families leveraged their wealth, bought their house to leverage their wealth to send their kids to college, or leverage their wealth to get equity to start a new business. But when the foreclosure crisis happened, our communities didn't recover from that. And now, communities of color, specifically and particularly Latinos and African-American communities, their household wealth has been now pennies on the dollar compared to white households.
It's kind of shocking when you look at the numbers, because according to your paper called People of Color Hit Hardest, it says African-American and Latino subprime borrower losses due to the foreclosure crisis represent 46% of all losses, even as these two groups represent 28% of the population. And then this is shocking. The loss of wealth between African-American and Latino subprime borrowers due to the foreclosure crisis is $213 billion. $213 billion just for blacks and Latinos?
Yes.
This is a massive, massive number.
Yeah. And what's really sad about this, Rose, is that recovery really hasn't happened in these communities, which is why you see still dilapidated homes, communities still struggling to recover. Recovering from the foreclosure crisis has been and it still is a huge disappointment. It's as if folks in these communities, communities of color, has been treated as merely collateral damage from the foreclosure crisis.
Oh, right. It was their fault because they signed the document. We still hear that. So overall, we're talking about a loss of $462 billion for subprime borrowers as a whole. And then again, for blacks and Latinos, $213 billion.
Yeah.
This doesn't really get mentioned much when we're talking about the foreclosure crisis.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't at all. Specifically in the Bay Area. You know, Rose, it's really kind of fascinating to juxtapose, because what's going on in the immediate Bay Area, where there's folks, communities like Stockton and parts of Sacramento, and of course even San Francisco, where we were really hit hard by the foreclosure crisis. Luckily, we had a very kind of aggressive attorney general who tried to and successfully did negotiate for a big part in terms of what California's slice of the pie would be in the huge settlement that she got from the banks. However, juxtapose and compare what's going on in our communities right now and what's going on in terms of a prospering industry in Silicon Valley. Why I bring that up specifically is because this is one of the few industries, the tech industry, that's not only been doing well, but has been making record profits during this administration. And this administration, specifically President Obama, was here a number of times not to speak to communities that were hit hard by the crisis, like in Oakland and Stockton and parts of San Francisco. Instead, he came here to the Bay Area to raise money, to raise a glass of champagne with tech industry execs. And it's really kind of disappointing to have seen that, not having seen something more meaningful of President Obama in the Bay Area, just interacting with communities in that regard.
This is getting a lot of attention right now just because we're seeing so many changes, specifically in San Francisco with rents going through the roof, a lot of families, people of color being pushed out. So when you talk about disappointments, what would you like to hear? Like on Inauguration Day, on MLK Day, what words would you like to hear?
Well, I think It's important to understand that on Inauguration Day, a lot of it is window dressing.
Yeah.
A lot of it is about symbolism. But ceremony and symbolism is very important. And I think I thought that President Obama really touched on the symbolic parts of how diversity matters. But symbolism has to be backed up with substance. And where I see a lack of substance so far in this regard, particularly in terms of diversity and how it matters, is his initial appointments to the cabinet. Incredibly undiverse, both gender-wise and ethnicity. Why this matter? Well, this matters because of this. If you want to make policy matter and impact people in an equitable way, you have to have people who reflect the community that got them elected. So far, the cabinet appointments just don't reflect that.
Can you elaborate on that?
Of course.
What are you talking about specifically?
So, just if you're looking at the appointments that, or the nomination that President Obama has made just in these last few weeks, they're basically all white men, which has been shocking. to the communities that got him elected. Basically, his progressive base of women all over the country, as well as communities of color. And we thought that since this is his second inauguration, his second administration, presumably he would have a lot more freedom in his choices to make the picks that he wants versus the picks that he has to make. So it's been very kind of disappointing to, I think, his progressive base, that he has made appointments that doesn't really reflect the base that got him into office, and hence we're skeptical as to whether they're properly informed and or even care about the communities that got him elected.
We're speaking with Samuel Kang, General Counsel for the Greenlining Institute. This is a national policy organizing and leadership institute working for racial and economic injustice. We were just talking about the report they published called People of Color Hit Hardest by the Foreclosure Crisis. And we'll put a link to this on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today is Inauguration Day. Just about an hour ago, President Obama was sworn in for a second term on a Bible owned by Martin Luther King Jr. This is the second time the inauguration and MLK Day have coincided. The first time was, I believe it was under Bill Clinton. I'm not remembering the year, 94?
Bill Clinton was first sworn in, I think, 93.
January, right. Yeah. So that was the other time that it happened. And a lot of commentators are drawing parallels between President Obama and MLK. And so what we decided to do on today's show was to check in with economic justice advocates to get their reaction to today's inauguration and really where we are when we're talking about poverty and inequality. 45 years after Martin Luther King's Poor People's Campaign, what is the state of economic justice in the United States as we see the poverty rate increasing, the number of people on food stamps increasing? What are your thoughts? What are your thoughts on all of these issues? And if you heard President Obama's speech this morning, what really stood out for you? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. What were you hoping to hear? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. What are your thoughts on the poverty issue in this country? Because there's also always been criticism that it really isn't raised during the presidential debates, that the politicians don't talk about it. And President Obama did mention the poor this morning.
Yeah, he mentioned it. I think, though it's a far cry from what this country's history has been, and actually in other past presidential administrations. Take, for example, the Kennedy/Johnson administrations and the war on poverty led by Sarge Shriver. There's a particular reason why they said this is the next movement. And tying into MLK Day, that was before he was tragically assassinated, mm-hmm. that was going to be his next movement, the war on poverty, because the link between civil rights and communities of color and poverty is inseparable. I think in terms of, if you can take it seriously, one thing that the president alluded to in terms of how we're going to recover it was talking about actually very kind of traditionally conservative rhetoric of personal responsibility. But I think what's important to remember, particularly on MLK Day, is that part and parcel of our personal responsibility as Americans is our responsibility to each other. That's where it was really preached by Dr. King, and the message on why poverty and dealing with it was important.
And he spent the last days of his life really fighting for justice for union workers.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I was wondering, well, I knew I wouldn't hear the word union in the speech today, but I was wondering if any commentators would bring this up, that he was a massive advocate for union workers. He was fighting for janitors. And just to, I just wanted to hear a little more analysis about what he did right before he was killed.
In terms of Dr. King?
Right.
Well, I can tell you, since I'm not a civil rights historian, I'm not sure exactly where I can add. But.
Well, I was saying that as the commentators were bringing up the parallels, I was hoping that, someone would bring that up, that that's what he spent his days fighting for. Well, and where are we today?
Yeah. Well, right now, today really mirrors kind of what we were going through 40 or 50 years ago. What I mean by that is you've seen the attack on public employees and organized labor in general across the country over these past few years. California, of course, aggressively fought it back successfully in terms of fighting back Proposition 32. But you've seen just kind of the vitriol being spewed out aimed at organized labor in this country over the past 4 years. And it seems like there's a lot of lessons to be learned just looking back 40 or 50 years ago by just recognizing that a lot of the standards that have been put in place in the United States in terms of labor, the eight-hour work day, the 40-hour work week, it would not have been there without organized labor. Mm-hmm. So it's important to recognize the movement that Dr. King fought for, his work with unions and the work against poverty to fight poverty, are really interlinked, and I hope it's something that this administration takes heed of.
And on poverty in the 60s, Dr. King said, quote, "There is nothing new about poverty. What is new, however, is that we now have the resources to get rid of it. The time has come for an all-out world war against poverty. The well-off and the secure have too often become indifferent and oblivious to the poverty and deprivation in their midst. Ultimately, a great nation is a compassionate nation. No individual or nation can be great if it does not have a concern for the least of these," end quote.
So there's one thing that Bay Area residents and your listeners particularly should know. I brought up earlier about the comparison of kind of the poverty that some of our immediate communities have been sustained with. But look right in Silicon Valley. We did a report last year in Tax Day, just recounting about how the Fortune 100 companies in America, but also particularly guilty are the top tech companies in Silicon Valley. They do a great job of hiding their profits offshore. And not only that, they've been leading the effort to try to get this money back, but at a severely reduced tax holiday. When we're talking about cutting the deficit, slashing social services, slashing Medicare, slashing benefits for veterans, there's something to that Americans should pay attention to, specifically Bay Area progressives, in terms of, well, when we're talking about slashing not just fat but bone here, where else can we look to for everybody to play a part to make sure all Americans are taken care of?
And so specific, let's talk about some specific policies. You all at the Greenlining Institute, you put out reports and you also put out suggestions. So what concrete changes would you like to see?
Well, for one, I think it doesn't do us any good to waste any more time about trying to play defense. I think in terms of this presidential administration, it came in on trying to be a conciliator of trying to bridge compromises. And I think this president learned early on that just hardly ever worked. Luckily, he had the numbers to pass the Affordable Health Care Act in Congress. He doesn't have that now, at least in the House, far from it. So, but I think there's a lesson to be learned here from the California example. So President Obama came in as a compromiser. I think Jerry Brown, our governor, came in trying to do the same thing of being a compromiser and was beaten back so severely. He got no Republican votes at all in his first budget. It was basically taped together, and luckily voters approved Proposition 30 by an overwhelming margin. What does prove as a pretty solid example of what this administration could do is look to someone who's been very close to this administration. That's our Attorney General Kamala Harris. She came out swinging, despite just having, by the skin of her teeth, having been elected in the previous election. But coming out of the blocks strong, coming out of the blocks fast, mm-hmm. she's been able to maintain a certain tone, and she's been able to maintain and push policies that make sense and that are equitable and are progressive. And I think that's something, that's a tone that this administration could possibly take as it starts to ramp up in the second administration.
What about activists? What role do you see them playing over the next 4 years? And just ordinary citizens who care about these issues.
Sure. Well, you can see what direction an administration is going to take just based on who the administration picks around them as advisors and top policymakers. And right now, we're a little bit skeptical because of who the initial picks are at the cabinet level for this administration. So far, nominees and picks that are not just not reflective of the base that got them in office, but not really even reflective at all of the initial picks he made when he was first elected back in 2008.
That is Samuel Kang, General Counselor for the Greenlining Institute, a national policy organizing and leadership institute working for racial and economic justice. And today we are getting reaction to President Obama's inaugural address. Happened this morning. He was sworn in on a Bible owned by MLK Jr. Today is also MLK Day. This is only the second time in history that the inauguration and MLK Day have coincided, or actually since MLK Day became a federal holiday. And we'd love to hear from you. If you listened to the speech this morning, what was your reaction? Did the president address issues that you care about? Specifically today, we are talking about economic justice, because that's what Martin Luther King Jr. dedicated his life to. He was fighting for unions and janitors just days before he was shot. And I also just wanted to find out what the minimum wage was back in 1968. And we just found those numbers. In 1968, when MLK launched the Poor People's Campaign, it was $1.60 an hour. And if you look at what it would be like today, accounting for inflation, it would be about $10.59. So that's what it is in San Francisco. But when you look at the federal minimum wage, it is just $7.25 an hour. It hasn't changed since 2009. So that's just kind of interesting to think about, that back in 1968, $1.60, accounting for inflation, it's about the same sure. as it is in San Francisco today.
Sure. You know, and what the minimum wage, even if it was that this in 2013, if it just accounted for inflation, the gap between what it takes to actually make it on a minimum wage and what it takes to actually for it to be a wage to live on, there's a disparity and a gap even there.
Well, let's hear from a caller, and you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go to Mike in Palo Alto. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Probably the most famous quote from Martin Luther King is, "Judge a man not by the color of his skin, but by the content of his character." Very eloquent, very much to the point. Your guest was lamenting a few minutes ago about an all-white cabinet, male all-white cabinet. And I'm wondering, especially on MLK Day, I'm wondering if your guest sees any contradiction between Martin Luther King's quote and lamenting just because of their white skin. Shouldn't the only qualification for an office or an important post be the how well they're qualified, and not whether or not they have white skins or they come from the, quote, wrong gender? It seems directly contradictory to what MLK was suggesting, that we should strive for a colorblind society, gender blind, and go for the content of their character.
Thank you, Mike. What are your thoughts, Samuel?
So thanks for that question, Mike. I think that was an excellent question. So what I don't think that Dr. King advocated for was necessarily a colorblind society. I think what he was advocating for was a race awareness society, at the very least. And what that entails is recognizing the accomplishments and the talents, but also the experiences of those who are not in the halls of power. And I think that's what I was alluding to in terms of the initial picks of this administration. He actually did a great job picking an administration and leadership in his first administration that was more reflective of America. And I think when you draw upon the experiences of a richer diversity and a greater depth and breadth of the American people, policy can only benefit that way.
Thank you. So thank you again, and thanks for calling, Mike. And after the break, I'd like to pose the same question to our next guest, Lisa Marie Alatorre. She is with the Coalition on Homelessness. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about this morning's inauguration, the inauguration speech, and it does fall on the same day as Martin Luther King Jr. Day. A lot of people are making parallels between the president and MLK. Today, we are talking about where we are 45 years after MLK's Poor People's Campaign. What will it take to truly address issues like economic inequality and poverty? It's Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show. And that's where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter. Just click on the email newsletter link on the right side of the page.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Food and Water Watch's Winona Howder. She's out with a really good book called Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. How should we respond to the ongoing corporate control of our food supply? We'll also talk about the history behind this, which is fascinating. That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about this morning's presidential inauguration. President Obama was inaugurated on the same day that the country is honoring civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. And many commentators are drawing parallels between the two. In this morning's speech, the president said we must be a source of hope to the poor, the sick, and the marginalized. So 45 years after MLK's Poor People's Campaign, when the minimum wage was $1.60 an hour, which adjusted for inflation would be exactly what it is in San Francisco today, even less at the federal level. We're talking $7.25 an hour. It has not changed since 2009. 45 million people officially living in poverty, according to the census. The number of people on food stamps is on the rise. So where are we today when we compare where we were in 1968? And what will it take to truly address these issues? Today, we're joined by Samuel King, General Counsel for the Greenlining Institute, a national policy organizing and Leadership Institute working for racial and economic justice. And now I would like to welcome Lisa Marie Alatorre to the show. She is with the Coalition on Homelessness, and they work to defend homeless and low-income people from attacks on their rights while advocating for permanent solutions to homelessness that take into account not only poverty's devastating effects, but also its root causes. Hi, Lisa Marie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for coming in. Yeah. And I wanted you to address Mike's comment that shouldn't we judge the people in the cabinet by their merit and not by their gender or their color?
Yeah, I really appreciate that question, and I really appreciate what Sam had to say in response to it. And I agree with what Sam said, and I also feel like I have another take on it, too. Yeah, I think that when Dr. King was speaking, he really thought that we would have come further than we have. I really think that he probably imagined that race wouldn't matter. And I think the fact of the matter is we still live in a society where it very much matters. And we haven't overcome the ways that racism is, you know, woven into the fabrics of our institutions, of our society, of, you know, many of the systems that we rely on to take care of us. We have racism inevitably woven into the fabrics. So when it comes to the importance of who is on, you know, the decision-making bodies of our different state systems or government, you know, government makeups, race absolutely matters, because the fact of the matter is that if you have an all-white panel, if you have an all-white board, if you have an all-white representation, then you aren't representing what's actually happening on the ground, particularly with poor people, particularly with our vulnerable populations.
Or, in this case, all-white men.
Absolutely, right? Then you're totally missing the point on so many other things, including gender, sexuality, probably class, probably other lived experiences that are really critical when it comes to making, you know, major policy decisions.
So before we get your take on the inauguration, I just want to go to another caller, because sure. She wanted to comment on Mike's call. Let's hear from Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa.
Yes, hi. And I also wanted to mention precisely about that same point about the content of the character and the judge not on the color of one's skin. I think it's been taken out of context so often. And I agree with your guest. Also, I think that we should look at the context in which Martin Luther King said that. There was an incredible amount of racism against black people during that time, and it was an exploding society. And if we look at the real facts behind racism, we're looking at also the fact that black people have been deprived of equal protection under the law. They've been deprived of land. The poor black farmers lost the land much earlier on. And I think that anybody who pretends to use that phrase and to state, sort of like blindly state that it doesn't, color doesn't matter, is basically not really living in this country.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Lisa. And if you'd like to call in and weigh on these issues and other things that came up for you this morning as you heard the inauguration speech and are reflecting back on Martin Luther King Jr. and what he stood for, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. And what can we do to really address these issues? I know we've been asking this question for years, but at this critical time, what can we do to address poverty and economic injustice, and also just what, I mean, people are facing when you're talking about most jobs that are being created pay less than $13.38 to be exact an hour with no benefits. How can we really address where what we're facing now and where we're going? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Lisa Marie, you focus on issues of poverty, homelessness, which is also on the rise when you look at how difficult. I have so many artist friends who cannot afford to stay in the Bay, in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts when you looked over President Obama's speech?
You know, I'm someone who always wants to love President Obama, for sure. And it's, you know, when you are also a politically conscious person, it can get really difficult to love our leaders, our charismatic leaders. And so, you know, I always try to approach things like the inauguration speech with a grain of salt, recognizing that this is a big fanfare, this is a media stunt, this is, you know, so much of this is just about propaganda that the state wants to put out, right? So just to preface that with a little bit of realness of who I am. But, you know, I am also a really hopeful person, and I'm very optimistic, and I really want to believe that that if we listen close enough to ourselves, we have the answers that we need to solve these problems. So, you know, in terms of looking over what Obama had to say and sort of framing it with MLK and Dr. King's lessons and particularly the Poor People's Campaign that he was on, you know, when he was murdered, I'm really disappointed that Obama doesn't get to the heart of what poverty and homelessness and the what's happening in our country. You know, he mentions it, he touches on it, but it's too bad that he can't talk about things like economic redistribution. And it's too bad that he can't, you know, he mentions tax system, but he doesn't ever get to the heart of where the problems lie with our tax system. And he mentions, you know, things like really great talking points, like we all deserve a dignified and just life. And yet he doesn't look at the way we criminalize poor people, the way we criminalize people of color, the ways, you know, and we see that every day here in San Francisco, but also, in, you know, in California in general. And Obama doesn't really touch at any of the real things that we're dealing with. You know, he doesn't, he just continues to, I guess, in some ways, play that role that we want from him as the president to give us this media fanfare.
The other thing I've been hearing from commentators is, because he did mention things like immigration, that's probably going to play a major role over the next 4 years.
Right.
Gun control, although he didn't specifically mention those two words this morning,
right. That
will take a large chunk of time over the next 4 years. And then people are wondering, what about poverty? Is this going to be an issue in the next 4 years? What are your thoughts on this, Samuel?
Well, I think it's important to realize that it was no accident to frame this around, have this inauguration day on MLK Day. Mm-hmm. But I think why this inaugural speech kind of missed a mark a little bit was because it seemed like the address itself took the day for granted. If you really look closely at this president's speech, though we anticipate especially having the inauguration day on this day, he didn't really allude to Dr. King all that much. It was more the rhetorical styles and the themes of Abraham Lincoln, an era that was just far worse in so many ways for progressives and people of color than it was in Dr. King's time. So I think in terms of addressing the modern and contemporary problems that communities of color face and the issues we deal with, poverty that still can be traced back just to 50 years ago, it missed a mark that way. Maybe it was a little bit more archaic in a way, if you will.
We have a comment on this from J.S. in Oakland, who said, in the war on poverty in the early 70s, an enormous amount of efforts, money, resources, and manpower were spent to establish and operate the community action agencies on local, state, and federal levels of government. Those were supposed to erase poverty and economic injustice. Why did this huge endeavor fail, and what can we learn from this? Are you both familiar with this? This effort in the 70s?
No, that sounds very interesting, though.
No, you're not either? I think maybe you're probably just born right around that time, I think. But J.S., thank you for the comments. Maybe we can elaborate on this question. I mean, you had the war on poverty under Lyndon B. Johnson, and there have been many, many efforts over the years. Why do you think we're still here? I mean, I guess maybe that's the other question, is why are we seeing these numbers actually increase? And wages are stagnant. In fact, Armand writes, I recently got an email that said our system is not broken. It was designed that way. Mm-hmm. Would your guests please comment on how we succeed and change with this fundamental problem, where we're at a time when back in the 70s, you were a union sheet metal worker. I'm talking about my father, with really good benefits, a very good salary, and not even a community college education. Today, again, the jobs are paying less than $13.50 an hour with no benefits.
I mean, on top of that, I think it's also important to remember that the 70s and the late 60s and early 80s were also a time of, like, be tough on crime. And we really saw an increase in how we criminalized folks who we saw as poor, as, you know, folks that we didn't want to see in public, whether they were queer or they were disabled or they were immigrants. And so at the time that we had these policies going on to attack poverty, at the same time, we had other policies that were going on that were criminalizing poverty. So we had the hugest skyrocket raise in prison populations, in prison building, in investing in corrections, and decreasing our investment in education, and decreasing our investment in social services. All of that was happening while we had these beautiful federal policies that people were spending lots of time in offices writing, but they weren't actually corresponding to what was happening on the local level, particularly around the local policies, around, you know, sentencing, corrections, increase in public safety, and let's invisibilize poverty. Let's lock it up. Let's put it away. Let's have these community beautification projects that we do. And none of that actually gets to the root cause of poverty. None of that actually lifts people out of the cycle of poverty. A lot of poverty we know is generational. A lot of poverty we know, you know, it's really hard to get out of in a capitalist society. You're the person whose point was that, you know, the system was set up this way. That's absolutely correct. We require a really large working class, poor, you know, sort of sustained group of people in order for the rich to continue to get richer, for our system to build the way it was supposed to build. So that person's absolutely correct. The system is working the way it's supposed to.
And we should be clear that when we're talking about poverty, there's this image that comes up, but we're talking about people who are working.
Absolutely.
Also, right?
Absolutely.
And in fact, a new report, we talked about this last week, just came out that found the number of people with jobs who are poor is on the rise.
Yeah. I mean, here in San Francisco, you are considered low income if you're a single adult and you're making $33,000 a year. That's so high compared to the national average. That's a person who's working, has a full-time job, probably has benefits, and yet they're still poor in this city. And why is that? Because we have such a gap. There's such a gap in terms of the rich-poor disparity here.
And one of the things to talk about is what is the government's role in all this?
Right.
What does the policymaking structure look like? You know, the corporate structure is one way, and, you know, the Supreme Court, unfortunately, over 100 years ago, I think nearly 100 years ago, ruled that a corporation is a person, just like any other person,
right,
like you and me. But that's the legacy that we're dealing with right now. But what is the governance structure that sets it up this way? Well, President Obama talked about a little bit in terms of, you know, what the role of government cannot and should not be something that tries to solve every single problem. But I think there's a distinct relationship that we have to examine more closely in terms of what is the relationship and structure that can be set of the private sector and the government sector working together. One of the potential solutions to this is something that is close to very close to the hearts of the Green Line Institute, and that's something called supplier diversity. And that's trying to get major corporations, other big corporations that try to distinguish themselves as a community corporation, to put their money where their mouth is by contracting more with local businesses, minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses. There are successful examples of this all throughout California, and this is one particular step that the government can take to see and examine how we can reinvest in communities locally and the business locally to address specific issues of poverty by investing money back into the communities where they exist.
That is Samuel King. He's general counsel with the Greenlining Institute, a national policy organizing and leadership institute working for racial and economic justice. We're also joined by Lisa Marie Alatorre. She's with the Coalition on Homelessness. They work to defend homeless and low-income people from attacks on their rights while advocating for permanent solutions to homelessness. And today on Your Call, we are talking about Inauguration Day. It's also MLK Day. And a lot of people are making drawing parallels between President Obama and Martin Luther King Jr. So we decided to bring on economic justice advocates and really talk about where we are today when it comes to things like income inequality, economic injustice, poverty, and get their reaction to the speech, where we are and where we're going. And we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And also, if you've been listening to some of the commentary, what are your thoughts on the parallels that are being drawn when you look at where we are today with poverty, 45 million people? This is according to the U.S. Census, so this is the official government number. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Lee in San Francisco. Hi, Lee.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I could not agree more that the disparities between those who have more than they should and those who lack is probably the most important matter we need to address as a nation going forward. I don't think it's the president's role to address that head on, certainly not from the podium of the inauguration. As well, I believe he needs to tread that line between being a forceful leader and being characterized as an angry black man, which he has still, you know, is in jeopardy of doing if he comes out in a very forceful manner about issues like poverty, which unfortunately affect minorities.
And Lee, is that the main reason why you don't think it's appropriate for the president to talk about these issues from the podium?
I think that, and also his role is to set the standard. And I think that he very clearly is pressuring those who are against social programs in his message. I really heard that loud and clear today. And that is his role. We have to pressure officials at other levels, at closer to home, to make real change. Governors, mayors, council people, and assembly people. We have to pressure and support them to make real change in this area and to form partnerships, quote unquote, with corporations to really address this head on going forward in the next 4 years. This is the time to do it, definitely. And he has made that clear. Can't take up the flag on that.
All right. Well, thank you for the comment, Lee. What are your thoughts on this, Lisa Marie, that this wasn't the time to address these issues?
I guess I disagree a bit, and I'd like to push back on what the caller said, because and one thing that the caller said that I do agree with is that it is up to the president to set the standard. And I think that that's why it is up to the president to bring these things up during his inauguration speech, to say that we are going to have a robust, you know, response to poverty and to the economic disparity that we have in our country. That would have been dreamy, you know, if we could hear a leader say something like that, really call it out as it is and not play this softball game. You know, and the other thing, too, I think it's really hard when we do this thing with President Obama. We're like, oh, we don't want him to be an angry black man. You know, that could be really bad for everybody. And I think when we have examples of folks like MLK, he was not seen as an angry black man. You know, he was seen as a very strong leader. Well, sure. You know, I think that there's ways in which we can also overcome those stereotypes that we have in our head when it's done in a politically sound, in a compassionate and in a grounded way that's honest and real and not coming, you know, we're all angry, but we all are also very compassionate and we also are very passionate about what we care about. And I think that Obama could really come at us with more passion and with more of a grounding in what's happening in the country and say things like, we have economic inequality, we have a huge problem with poverty, and we will not just respond to it with increased criminalization, with increased, you know, invisibilization of the problem.
You know, I couldn't agree more, Lisa Marie. If it can't be the president, the leader of the free world, to deal with one of the most enduring issues and really a kind of a stain kind of on the American identity, on poverty, then whom? The bully pulpit of the United States is arguably the most powerful bully pulpit in the world and probably in human history. Especially in a divided Congress where it's going to be so hard to push policy, the bully pulpit is the perfect opportunity to push on issues as ubiquitous as poverty. If he can't do it, who can and who will? And just to give a more pragmatic economic argument, poverty impacts all of us, not just the poor.
Mm-hmm.
Folks who are on social services have to take more because we have to give more to those folks to lift them up. But that's something that also chips away our economy, too, because they're not working.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really interesting point that I'd love to elaborate on another show, just how does poverty affect communities beyond the obvious? I think it's such a great comment. Thank you. And thank you again for calling in, Lee. We've got about 5 minutes left, and why don't we go through a few callers, and then we'll get responses from Lisa Marie and Samuel. Let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Good morning, Rose, and thank you very much for taking my call. One of the things that has to be kept in mind is the role of free trade and globalization of the economy, and that, of course, started in the late 1970s, worked up to the present time. And that, of course, is these trade agreements which deindustrialize America so that it's difficult to find anything made in the United States anymore. And, of course, they also serve to break industrial unionism so that you have less than 10% of the workforce today that is represented by 10% of those outside the public sector that are represented by a labor movement. And, of course, last year you had the president sign three trade agreements with Colombia, Panama, and Korea, all of which were opposed by organized labor, but the president signed them anyway. So you have this problem of union weakness, and therefore you get hundreds of millions of people working at low wages.
Right. Yes, an ongoing problem, and there's another trade deal in the works. According to Public Citizen, all of these deals are still happening behind closed doors. So thank you for that. We'll get a response in just a minute. First, let's hear from Jonathan in San Francisco. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi. I wanted to, second that comment that John just made, which is very powerful. But the other thing I want to point out is earlier, I think it was you, Rose, that said something about you have artist friends that can't afford to live in the Bay Area anymore.
Right.
And when I thought about that, I thought, the difficulty with pushing something like that is that you're instantly taking a very subjective subject like art. And if you attempt to do any sort of redistribution of wealth to subsidize those people, that's not going to appeal to the moderate, you know, middle-of-the-road community at all because, quite honestly, I like ruined beer, but if people don't want to buy it, they don't want to buy it. And that's the difficulty with saying something like, well, you know, I've got artist friends. Well, you know, it's arts. While it's nice to be able to sell it, it most of the time is like brewing beer. It's a hobby. So that's difficult to subsidize a life like that.
Well, some of them are full-time musicians, and they can't make ends meet. So do you want to comment on that,
yeah,
Samuel?
I would. I just want to speak as a person who is a capitalist as well as an American and someone who is still progressive, consider themselves progressive besides being a capitalist, is that from having lived in this city and other major cities, the artist community is what attracts me to live there. It makes it a more vibrant city. But besides the kind of the existentialist kind of benefits of living in a vibrant artist community, I think the arts have a tendency of reflecting the values, the culture, as well as just how the identity of who lives in that city. And if not for artists, with these other mediums besides your mainstream way of getting the news and information, it would make it a less vibrant city, a less interesting place to live. So I think having a community that is welcoming of the arts and arts community is not only something that is intrinsically beneficial, it is economically beneficial as well.
Jonathan, you still there?
Enough of a community, yeah, but if there's not enough of a community to come to your shows, to buy your art, well, then that's just the nature of the beast. And I agree with you, art does make a vibrant community. And I agree that, you know, I love going to music shows as well, but at the end of the day, if there's not enough people to sustain your living, you cannot expect society as a whole to subsidize that just because that's something you enjoy doing.
I want to push back a little, Jonathan, and say that I think that it's okay that we live in an abundant society where we have things like art, because it, to me, art is not extra. Art is absolutely one of those pieces that's necessary for society to be whole, for society to be beautiful. And I think that because we live in a society that comes from this model of scarcity, that there's not enough to go around, there's only a little bit, that because of that, we have to cut corners and we have to cut this and we have to cut these basic needs. And I would argue that art is one of those things that's it's ingrained in education. It's ingrained in history. It's a part of culture and society. It's necessary. And we should be living in an abundant society where we have everything that we need to survive and to be fruitful and beautiful. And we don't need to operate from models of scarcity.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. I'll note your comment down for our next editorial meeting. It sounds like we should do another show about art, because I'm hearing a lot of people talk about this again, especially in the Bay Area. We've got about a minute left. Final thoughts from you, Samuel, as we're on Inauguration Day, MLK Day. We're really thinking about these issues. At least I hope we are.
Yeah, I think it's really important just to remember two things. One is don't take this administration for granted. Though progressives got him into office, we have to hold him accountable to make sure he reflects the values and the policies and the priorities that we want him to reflect. And secondly, on this day of service, let's just try to take care of one another a little bit more. The president alludes to taking personal responsibility. As I said earlier on, I think what's really important and personal responsibility as Americans is taking responsibility to one another.
And I forgot to mention, this is a $50 million inauguration. $50 million.
And this was supposed to be low-key this year.
Right. Your final thoughts, Lisa Marie?
I want to say thanks a lot for having me here. It was a really great conversation. I think I appreciate what Sam just said, and I would also encourage folks to remember that we have a lot of power here on the local level, and if we don't have faith in our administration, we can have faith in ourselves, and there are things that we can do here on the local level to fight what's happening and to make changes and to hold our president accountable by modeling what we want.
Lisa Marie Alatorre is with the Coalition on Homelessness, and Samuel Kang is general counsel for the Greenlining Institute. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you so much for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. How should we respond to the corporate control of our food supply? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Winona Howder, author of Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. She writes about the history of our food system, the rise of Monsanto and GMOs. What is the historical perspective of our food supply? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And what are your concerns about the food industry? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.